Hi there, Purnima.
Hey, how are you?
Very good. This is Eric Coppolino, Pacifica Radio, Planet Waves.
Yes, I know. I just saw your number.
Wonderful. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay.
Good. How are you handling the pressure of a private person being thrust into public life?
Well, nothing new. I mean, I've always sort of known the truth, so it doesn't. The only thing is, you know, you're gonna get hammered, but oh well.
Right. Well,
that's just the way it works, okay? These people need to be dragged by their short hairs towards the truth. Now, if they don't want to go there, then that's their problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. The study that you're working on, or that you have you completed this paper on the analysis of the samples?
On the jabs or the virus?
No, the thing that got my attention about your work was the, I believe it was 1,400 COVID-positive samples, and you were asked
to
take those.
Oh, yeah, the 1,500, yeah. We had 1,500, yeah. We that was done in 2020. We are just trying to publish those, and we have not been successful with publishing it with the journals. So
right.
What I'm doing is one of our postdocs, his name's Sam. He's trying to publish the study privately in Texas through a private publisher. And we also sent the draft. My dad, who worked for Pfizer, my dad has a friend who just retired from the National Institutes of Virology in India, in Pune, India.
Mm-hmm.
And this friend, my dad's friend, Dr. Joshi, he contacted me, I think it was like a week ago, 2 weeks ago, maybe. And he said, you know, if we send the draft to him, he might try to publish it in India. Because I think the Indians are sort of figuring out what the hell is going on. It's just the West that just can't figure shit out.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I would love to see the draft, if that's possible, or at least the methodology section. I'm curious, when you say that the goal was to isolate the virus, and that was the assignment, right? Isolate the virus from those 1,500 positive samples, right?
Yeah, we had quite a few samples, actually, and we did the isolation 3 times because my PI was a pain in the ass. I mean, she kept saying, oh, yeah, I think there's, cross-contamination and this and that. And because her goal was to actually, she believed that there was a virus.
Mm-hmm.
I kept telling her there's no virus.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even want to be a part of this group. I didn't want to do the isolation studies.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so can we talk about the methodology? What computer software were you using? Which gene alignment program were you using?
We used BLASTP.
Right.
So, okay, so that's, I mean, and then we use the Zeiss Gemini 6 SEMs, the scanning electron microscopes. And that was essentially the scanning electron microscope we had in the lab.
Right.
But, I mean, the other stuff, and you use vacuum, you can either use gravity filtration or you can use vacuum filtration to get the supernatant in the beaker. Because you have to do a filtration process.
What form did the samples come in?
They were all lung aspirates. This is early on in April because they were actually, people were showing up with pneumonia and bilateral pneumonia and stuff like that.
So
because
you had,
there was no.
Go ahead, please.
Go ahead.
No.
A lot of these, we didn't get any nasal swabs. I think she had actually asked them for lung aspirates because she didn't, you know, the nasal swabs are hard to, the nasal swabs are contaminated, okay? There's a lot of stuff on the nasal swabs.
Mm-hmm.
So
well,
you get ethylene oxide and you get a bunch of other stuff on there, and you can't really do much with nasal swabs. And PCRs have never, ever been done. If they do a PCR, you've never done a PCR up somebody's nose. I mean, I've never heard of anybody going up anybody's nose before this. The PCRs were always done as cheek swabs. Always.
Because you get more material?
Yeah, and you get saliva. Yeah, absolutely. You just have to twirl that thing inside your cheek, you know? So why were they going up people's noses is my question.
Well, do you have a theory about that?
I can have all the theories I want, but I think I'm going to get roasted if I say, you know, damned if you don't, damned if you don't do, you know? But, I mean, I've never heard of any, this is the first, and no, I don't understand why not a single person even brought this up, is why are they going up the nose when everything, all DNA analysis, all RNA analysis is done through a cheek swab? I mean, always.
Mm-hmm.
Why they were going up people's noses is beyond me. I mean, unless they were putting something up there,
mm-hmm.
but, you know,
mm-hmm.
You understand? I mean,
of
why
course.
Would you go up somebody's nose, and why was that swab that long?
Yeah.
And why did it have bristles? Why couldn't you just have a, usually the swabs are a sterile cotton, it's just a cotton swab on a wooden stick, okay? That's how you swab people.
And they were using bristled swabs, not just...
They're using these brushy, they're using these plastic long, you know, they're on these plastic sticks, and the tip of it was like a, you know, like bristles on a toothbrush. I mean, some of them were, you know, they, most of them had that, and they had this curly little, you know, it was like a spiral pattern, you know, most of the swabs were. So why were they having, I don't understand. I just don't understand. I mean, why you would use something, the bristly kind of swab up people's noses.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, and why was it, why were they going up that high? You could just, you know, just at the very entrance of your nostril, you could just do it there, right?
It's very strange.
Why do you need to go all the way up?
I mean, I don't understand it.
I'm a virologist. I don't understand it. I'm like, what would the snot be different up there as opposed to at the very tip of your nostrils? I mean, I'm confused.
Yeah. It is,
right?
Strange.
I mean,
it is very strange.
Right?
I agree.
I'm asking you. This is common sense.
Yes.
So I don't know. I mean, everything about this whole thing is just a disaster, and nobody's asking any real questions.
So,
I mean, nobody. People in academia.
Of course. So let's focus on methodology. So at least you had supernatant. That's really important. I think it's amazing that you had 1,500 samples of supernatant.
Yes, she worked hard on this thing. She was looking at a Nobel Prize or something, you know, she was absolutely excited about this. She had worked her ass off, you know, to make sure she got all the samples and everything. And, you know, she had worked with the NIH and, you know, to procure all the samples and blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was all perfectly taken care of. And,
And these were California
these
residents?
These were from all over California, mostly from Southern California.
And what was the institution that was doing this?
The lab?
Yes.
I'm not, I can't give out the information on that.
Can you give me a clue? Like, was it under a private institution, a state institution?
It was a university in Texas.
Okay. So somehow a university in
because
Texas
I'm
gets
getting,
the contract.
I'm going to get my ass sued. I mean, I'm going to publish a paper under, you know, we're going to have to just, the way we're going to have to do this, I think, because my PI, I just found out my PI went to Costa Rica and she died there. I knew she had gone there. I don't know what the hell was going on. I found out yesterday she passed away.
This is your boss?
Yes.
Is this the one who was going to get the Nobel Prize? She wanted the Nobel.
Yes.
Okay. And she died?
Yeah. So Sam Gomez, okay, who is a postdoc who was very close to her, he used to work in her lab. He was in touch with her because after the lab got raided last April, the lab got raided on the 25th of April of last year by the FBI, okay? 27, they showed up at my doorstep.
27?
Of April, so 2 days later.
And did
they
have a warrant?
The FBI, you guys, they showed me their badge. They showed me some kind of a warrant. And this was weird because it was... Two days after they raided the lab, but there was also something else going on. I got some kind of a call And from somebody at the NIH, and they said, you know, they worked with Fauci or some BS like that. And I don't know, it was a private number. And they just said something and then they hung up. And then the next day, the FBI shows up at my doorstep, which it's just, the whole thing is just bizarre. I mean, it's like the Twilight Zone. I'm a nobody, nothing. Okay. I mean, I'm just like a regular lab person. It's like, I don't know why. But I think I know why these guys were doing what they were doing. Mm-hmm. There's about 12 labs that I know of. Six labs, five are here in California, one on the East Coast, that have done the isolation studies. They're not speaking up. One tried to, but they got told not to do anything, and then I think they lost some of their funding, I believe, from the NIH, because a lot of the funding comes from the NIH. You know that, right?
Of course. So what were the results? You got 1,500, these 1,500 samples, you're running them in BLAST, and what happened?
Well, so the first time we did the isolation, which you do the gravity filtration, then you look at the sample, then you have to have one uniform layer of cells, okay? I mean, you're looking at the size of, I think the size was between 50 to 120 nanometers. That's what the size is of a viral particle, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And then you have to make sure that all the other cellular debris, bacteria, fungi, any other human cellular debris, everything is out, because you also have to make sure that you do a biochemical analysis. We also ran, do you know what an agarose gel is?
Is it part of the PCR?
The agarose gel.
Is it centrifugation? Is it for the centrifuge?
The agarose gel is essentially when you do a biochemical analysis through like the Maxim Gilbert, when you do the sequencing, you know, the genome sequencing to match up to see if it matches. Mm-hmm. Whatever you get, once you get the supernatant, then you centrifuge, you do the density band. Then you actually do a biochemical analysis, what you micropipette out, the 1.116 nanograms per deciliter, that layer that you pipette out. Then you do a biochemical analysis of what you just pipetted out. And you see, you do a gene sequencing on that to see if that matches up with what you're seeing, that viral genome, that 30,000, 40,000 SARS-CoV-2, okay?
Meaning that you do a metagenomic transcript, you're using metagenomics, right?
Yes. But you also have to follow up with something else, and most labs don't do this. You actually put it, you do an agarose gel just as a backup to actually see the particles of RNA and DNA, and the lighter particles of RNA or DNA will show up at the top, and then the heavier ones will float to the bottom of the agarose gel. You put these, you have to use a micropipette, and you actually put them, it is part of the PCR sequencing, yes. And you actually have to put them in these wells. Then you have to put the whole gel, it dries out. Then you put it into what is called ethidium bromide. Then you wait for the ethidium bromide to do its job. Then you use ultraviolet light to actually look at the agarose gel. And then you see the entire, you see this whole platform, you know, you see this whole stuff bleeding out into the gel. So you get the DNA, the pieces of DNA or RNA that are heavy, they actually float down, because you do what is called electrode, you use an electrode current, okay? And the current actually helps all these DNA to separate, the DNA or RNA to separate, and then you see all of that. That will tell you if it indeed is, that's like a backup for the genome sequencing. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes. And then,
and most labs never do that. That is a surefire way of saying, okay, look, because now you're actually proving physically that there is an RNA sequence there that is actually matching up with that genomic sequence that these people are putting on BLASP or whatever. It's not just like a computer thing. You're actually physically seeing the particulate as RNA or DNA.
Right, but how do you know it's the right RNA or DNA? You have to. Can you sequence that?
Say that again.
How do you know that the particles that you're seeing are the thing you think they are?
Well, that's why you have to do this, the agarose gels, because that gives you, because what you get over there, then you match the agarose gels, the DNA fragments or the RNA fragments, to what then you found with the genomic sequence. So it's like a double check. You know, you're double checking with the agarose gels. Usually, a good lab will do that, and mm-hmm. most labs don't do the agarose gels. And for RNA and DNA, you just use an agarose gel. For proteins, when you're doing it for proteins, it's called a polyacrylamide.
Okay. So what you seem to be saying is that you didn't find any virus.
No. It was just human RNA. I mean, when you get sick, RNA and DNA breaks off from the cells, and that's what that was. I mean, it was just RNA floating around in the system.
Mm-hmm.
It was just human RNA.
Right. And did these match each other, or they were all different?
They were different. I mean, this human RNA, and now some of the sequences in the, I think a few of the strands, you know, again, because it was a cobbled up, it's an in silico cobbled up genome that uses that, something else, some of those. But again, you know, this is why when people do these PCRs, they show up as positive because anything and everything is part of that genome. Do you see what I'm saying? So it picks up this, picks up that. And they've actually, the PCR swabs, the PCR test actually that they're using is actually the 40 or 50, I don't know what it was, the 40, 50 base pairs, I think, that they programmed into it from Wuhan, that patient zero. It is actually human RNA. It's not viral RNA. And it was just a fragment, just a fragment.
What do you know about patient zero?
I don't know much. I just know there was just one patient. There was actually 10 patients, but only one patient they did the lung lavage on, apparently.
Well, there are two sequences that were published, the Wu team and the Ren team, I believe.
I see.
Do you know these provenances? One is MN908947, and the other one is 402123.
I didn't know there was two sequences. I thought there was just one.
Well,
so
yeah, I mean,
you know,
there was something like 150 by late January, but the famous ones are I believe the Lili Ren team and the Fan Wu team, and one is taken from a 41-year-old patient, and one is taken from a 61-year-old patient, the guy with many, many different diseases, and that becomes 402123.
I see.
So you didn't know which one you were matching against? In other words, do you know the one what you were matching against?
Well,
the in silico.
I mean, we were just sent a code and we just looked at that. I mean, that's pretty much it. It was in BLASTP, and it was, I mean, you know, again, it was, I can look back and see which sequence we looked at, but, you know.
Okay.
I was under the impression there was only one sequence. I mean, I was told it was one sequence, and that's it.
Okay. So essentially what you're saying is you had that one sequence, and then you had these 1,500 samples of COVID-positive patients by PCR that allegedly matched the primers of that in silico sequence, and you were attempting, sounds like you're saying, to actually find the virus in those samples and see if the virus actually matched the target.
Right.
And it didn't.
No. And we didn't use all the 1,500 samples because we had to, you know, reiterate this three times. And then when we did the controls, there was nothing going on with the controls either. I mean, there was nobody, the ferrets weren't getting sick or anything like that. I mean, the ferrets weren't getting sick with even the stuff that we injected into them. So, I mean, they lost some of them, I think like 10 or something, lost a little bit of hair on their tails, but that's about it. I mean, there was really no other sequelae at all. I mean, there was no, you know, there's no pneumonia in the lungs, no, nothing like that. So,
did you use a cell culture to create extra virus when you injected it into the ferrets, or you used supernatant?
No, we were just using the supernatant. We didn't use anything else.
How many milligrams of it came in with each patient?
Into which, what do you mean?
How many cc's were in each sample?
I think it was like I think it was less than 0.2 cc's or something like that. It was a very small amount. So
I see. So that's like a fifth of a. That's like let's see. Anyway, okay, I'm having trouble doing my metric conversions in my mind, but a fifth of a cc is like almost 200 milligrams.
Yeah, it was a very small dose. Like milligrams. I mean, literally, we had to do this three times, and it's. I think people were getting frustrated by the second and third time. It was just ridiculous because there was no. I mean, I don't understand why, you know, we had to do this three times because. And I kind of understand where she was coming from because it's a you need to reproduce the results over and over again to make sure that there's no you didn't leave anything out, but it I think once would have been fine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you didn't need to do this three times over.
Right. On the samples that you used, you did it three. How many of those 1,500 were actually processed?
We used about 756, I think,
okay.
we actually processed.
That's a lot. I mean, if you can't find it in there.
It was a big sample size, okay? I mean, it's a huge sample size.
Yeah.
I think that should have, actually, there's another lab in Italy that actually did a bigger sample of about 3,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There was a lab, I don't know where, but I mean, six labs have done it in Europe. I don't understand why people aren't. I know this is, I've heard this from the colleague who are doing in fact, there's two Russian scientists I'm working with. They said that there's a lab in Italy, an Italian university that actually has used about 3,000. They did this back in 2020 that actually have done the isolation studies the right way.
Right.
But now, I don't know why they have not published. I don't know why they're not actually putting anything out. So our sample size compared to theirs was much smaller.
Yes. Now, a question about how you transitioned from finance into molecular biology. You have an impressive career in finance, and then How do you wind up going into molecular biology?
Well, I ended up going from I actually was in finance for not that long. I mean, I got my degree in 2000 May from University of Fairbanks, Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up, my sister was actually doing her biochemistry work in India. Actually, my sister has an economics degree too, and then she transitioned into biochemistry, and she was working at the DRI at Desert Research Institute in Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And she was sort of, you know, saying, hey, you know, why don't you, because most of my family, my dad and everybody, my dad's a biochemist. My grandfather was a medical doctor. On my mom's side, we've got a bunch of physicists and doctors as well. And I started working in my dad's lab when I was much younger. And I've always sort of, you know, been attracted to the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of pressure. I'm from India. Parents put a lot of pressure, you know, to go into the sciences or engineering. And I kind of wanted to do something different, so I ended up going into finance. And then I kind of got... finance is very, very dry. And I mean, it was okay. It was just okay. I mean, it was paying the bills and stuff. But I think after my younger sister, who is about a year, 9 months younger than me, she, you know, went into biochemistry. I thought, okay, you know, I should probably go into this. We discuss a lot. We talk on the phone quite a bit. And so I ended up essentially coming down to California, and then I essentially started out. I actually started doing some work at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. I was taking classes there, and I started working in a lab there as a lab tech. I started doing work there, and then I continued. When I moved down to California, I started working at SBCC. I started taking classes. I started out as a lab tech, worked at Judy Evans Myers' lab, her microbiology and cell biology lab, and I worked with people at UCSB. And so it just started there. And then she started essentially seeing things, and we did, you know, we did work on fungi and things like that, and we started seeing stuff in fungal isolations that just didn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. Like with coccidioides mycosis, I mean, they kept saying, you know, coccidioides, the spores essentially cause coccidiomycosis.
Mm-hmm. You applied to London School of Tropical Medicine?
I did it because Judy essentially made some calls, yes. She had contacts there.
Okay, so you when did you get in there?
I got in there in 2013, I believe, and then I graduated in 2016, December.
So you were there basically for 3.5 years?
Yeah, but I was also, I was going back and forth. I mean, I was working in Texas, at Austin in the lab. I was doing some lab work there, and I was just going back and forth. You can do a lot of stuff. A lot of my coursework was online, but actually you have to do the lab work either at a university abroad, or you actually have to go over there and do the lab work there as well, which I was spending 6 months of my, you know, of the year over there. So that's why I was just going back and forth.
What are your two PhDs in?
One is in virology and one is in immunology.
And did you write dissertations?
I have not published, no.
No, did you write dissertations to graduate, thesis?
Yeah, I wrote one, yes.
You wrote one thesis. What was the topic?
It was malaria and HIV. It was essentially, I was doing a work on malaria and HIV.
And how do you... Yes?
It was malaria, essentially co-infections with HIV, co-infections with malaria.
And you didn't publish this dissertation.
What do you mean I didn't publish
it? You're saying you didn't, is it published?
Well, the London School of Hygiene has my dissertation, and I have a copy of my dissertation, but it's, I mean, I don't understand what you mean by published, as in a journal, or?
No, I guess, yeah, I don't mean published like in a journal. I mean, like, is it available in the library?
It should be available in their library, yeah.
And 3.5
because
years.
Because they usually, they call it, they deposit the information in their system.
Mm-hmm. And what was the core
thesis? Anybody
who
graduates with a PhD, they deposit their PhD thesis in their system.
What was the title of the dissertation?
It was essentially malarial and HIV co-infections.
Yeah, but you state the thesis in the title. What's the title?
That was the title.
So say that again, slowly. Malaria?
Malarial and HIV co-infections.
In whom?
That was actually the title. It was not in whom, it was just, that was the title.
And what did you study? What was the basis of the experiment?
Well, the basis of the experiment was that HIV was not, you know, there was nothing, there was no virus called HIV, and malaria was a separate disease, and there were no co-infections at all. I mean, that was essentially the theme of the paper.
And it concludes that there are no co-infections.
Correct.
And did you conclude as well that HIV did not exist?
Yes, and I also concluded that malaria was actually a nutritional deficiency, as it was not caused by Plasmodium. I mean, it didn't sit well with them, but I mean, there is no proof that the Plasmodium parasite or Plasmodium protozoan actually causes malaria. It is a nutritional deficiency of folate and vitamin B12.
Right.
So that was essentially the theme of the whole thing, that these are not co-infections. There's nothing in patients that is causing any co-infections whatsoever, because these are not even infections.
Right. So when you were questioned, I mean, you went to the panel, right? You're questioned by three other professors, right?
I think there was actually six of them. Because it was on two different occasions, they didn't want this study even. I mean, it was, the whole thing was They didn't want me to do anything on malaria. And when I chose this topic, because malaria was not part of, you know, it's not a virus. So, but there are case studies in Africa and in India where people with, you know, with beta thalassemia minor or even beta thalassemia major, and people who have malaria actually have been seen with quote-unquote co-infections of HIV. And what I was saying is HIV doesn't exist. There's no infection of HIV in any of these patients that they're saying that actually have malaria or have contracted malaria. And malaria is not a disease that is caused by a parasite.
How did you conclude they didn't have HIV?
I couldn't find anything where, you know, they've actually said anything about HIV. There's not a single paper that, I mean, there's just assertions that HIV was, you know, through testing, was that these people were having co-infections of HIV through antibody testing. But there was no, I mean, there's no other real paper that presented itself as saying, okay, that this was, that they actually had co-infections or HIV was even present. Because there's no, nothing was ever isolated with HIV. Nothing was ever done with HIV. They've just said that HIV exists, and they do a bunch of testing, but the person was not showing any HIV symptoms. The T cell counts were fine. So I, just based on the test, the antibody test, if people are showing up positive as HIV, that does not mean that, you know, the person has HIV.
How big was your cohort?
I think the cohort was about, it was small. It wasn't that big. It was about 25.
Okay. So there's 25 people who tested positive. They were HIV positive on ELISA or Western blot?
It was actually, I think some were on the ELISA and some were on the Western blot. But very few were using the Western blots because now they mostly use the immunosorbent assays.
Okay, and these 25, were they positive on PCR?
I don't think they were positive on PCR. It was mostly just ELISA.
Okay, so you're looking at a group of people who are, they're testing positive for malaria on what assay for malaria?
They use ELISA for malaria as well.
Okay, so basically you take a group
They use ELISA pretty much. ELISA is like the new, they're using the immunosorbent assays. They very rarely, I think some parts of Africa still use Western blot, but they have mostly now moved over, like in India, they've mostly moved over to like ELISA.
Right. Okay. So you got a group of 25 patients who are ELISA positive for these two claimed infections, HIV and malaria. And then what did
Correct.
You? And so when you they're positive on the HIV positive on the ELISA test, I guess you pronounce it. And what did you? How did you go from having an HIV positive patient to then being able to assert in your paper that they were not positive?
Well, because I didn't find a single paper where they've ever isolated anything on HIV. I mean, they've never isolated HIV at all. So just saying that it's a test that they're doing, but what is the test based on? So, I mean, if you can't actually isolate the virus and show that HIV is actually causing a disease or a set of symptomology, then, you know, you can't say it's an infection with HIV. I mean, it's that simple.
No, I understand that part deeply. I mean, I've been following this carefully. I'm familiar with the work of Duisberg. But the question is, this goes in the face of people lose their labs for this. They lose their careers and reputations for this. How did you get past that?
I didn't get past it. I mean, they essentially initially. I mean, they didn't even. I was not. I literally was not going to get my PhD. I mean, I was probably not going to get my PhDs. I had one professor pull some strings on me because they were not happy with what I was even presenting. It was completely anti-scientific in their opinion and just not complete bullshit and utter crap. So, and I said to them, I said, fine, if you don't want to give me a PhD, that's fine. I'll just leave.
Well, I mean, you accomplished something that I've never heard of before. Regarding HIV, I mean, I know the depth and scope of the scandal.
They just wanted me gone. Okay, I think they acquiesced because of this one professor that was sort of, he liked this one professor. It's just like Judy. I mean, you got one or two professors who help you out, and I threw a tantrum, and I mean, I actually did say, I said, look, if you don't give me the PhD, I'll just leave. I mean, I'll just go away. That's fine. This is the PhD thesis. You don't want to accept it. That's fine by me.
My
parents weren't very happy with it. I'll tell you that. My parents were pissed off. I mean, my father was not talking to me for almost 2 years after this mess.
Which mess? Because you mean the controversy over whether you should be granted the doctorate?
Well, no, the fact that, you know, I actually put up a fight and saying, don't give me the, if you're not going to give me the PhDs, don't give me the PhDs, I'll just leave.
Right.
My father was essentially saying, why do you always have to fight with people?
Yeah.
You know, you're always being a pain in the ass. I mean, he actually said that to me. He says, you know, you're always fighting with people. You're always on the wrong side of everything. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you always have to fight with people? Why do you always have to make a big mess out of things? Why did you even bother going and getting these PhDs?
Yeah.
My parents are coming here to see me on, you know, September 3rd, which is next week. And my father brought that up again. He says, you know, why don't you just get the hell out of all the sciences? Just keep your mouth shut. Be quiet, come back to India, stay on the farm,
be a good girl.
Well, no, he told me, he says, listen, you know, he says, you're 50 years old, I just celebrated a birthday. He says, look, you're not married, you don't have kids, you don't have anything to look forward to in life, just get on with life, just forget about everything, just come home.
Right. Did you reference the Perth group in your doctorate?
I actually put them as a reference, yeah.
Because, you know, I know their work, and I think that they're spot on.
They are spot on. Judy Evans Meyer, she actually, you know, she was the one who actually pushed me towards the Perth group, and I had read about Lanka way back in 97, 98. I mean, I was reading his stuff, and I was like, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. Because the stuff that Stefan Lanka was saying made total sense. But Stefan Lanka was like he was the only person who was saying this. And then the Perth group, I think, was saying pretty much the same thing that Stefan was saying.
Right. I mean, it's quite incredible to reference people who are this controversial. I mean, reviled.
I don't have a job, okay? I've been fired and I lost two jobs. I've been fired from two labs, and this was a disaster in itself. I mean, I think whatever I touch turns to shit.
Well, people are certainly following you now. They're paying very close attention to you now.
I'm not interested. I'm not like Malone or any of these people, you know, trying to make a big buck or anything. I think I'm just sick and tired of all this BS that's going on. I'm just tired of it. I mean, there's no monkeypox. I don't understand how people don't understand this. I mean, even you don't need a PhD. You just need common sense, correct? I mean, am I right?
I would agree with that. Yeah, I mean, some of the most uneducated people get it completely. They understand exactly what's going on.
I mean, the person who works on our farm on my dad's farm in India, you know, he sent me an email. He said to me, "There's no virus." I said, "Yeah, there's no virus. You're right." He's and not because he was listening to what I was saying. He's been saying this, you know, since 2020. He's like, there's no virus, man. There's no virus. They're just making this stuff up. Now he understands it. I don't understand why virologists and all these other. I don't get it. I have no idea. I don't know what people are. You know, I don't know what Kool-Aid people are drinking. And I think most people, regular Joe Schmoes, I think they understand it. I think they're just living in fear. I mean, my father is a very smart man, but he's completely, he worked for Pfizer. He's boosted, and I don't understand this. My mother lost her eye. Oh. She's actually got a hole in her macula in her right eye.
From what?
And she wants me to take her to the, she took the COVID shield. The two shots of the COVID shield, which is AstraZeneca. It's actually made by Serum Institute of India.
And it blinded her?
Yeah, she blind in her right eye. She had a blood clot in her right eye and essentially created a hole in her macula. She went to the doctors, and the doctor said, well, this stuff happens. You know, you're getting old.
Yeah.
This is after a booster. I mean, her third shot. It's like, and my parents just... I don't know. I don't even know why I'm doing this crap.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're being guided, and you know you're obviously passionate, and I think are driven by a sense of justice. So, can we schedule a slower, more structured interview where we break this down and pace it a little bit better?
If you can put up with my BS.
I'm just going to keep you focused. We're going to go one topic at a time. One last thing. Not everyone feels good about this, but do you mind sharing your birth data with me? I'm an astrologer. I'm probably the only investigative reporter who's an astrologer. But anyway, if you would share it, I'd be very happy.
Oh, God, I hope you find something good about my astrology chart. If my astrology chart is upside down, that would be depressing. It's the 24th of August, 1972. And maybe you can tell me something. Maybe you'll tell me I'm crazy or out of my mind. I don't know. Maybe both.
What time?
The time of birth was 4:40 in the morning.
And what city?
Mumbai, India, which is what is called Bombay.
Wonderful. Okay, Purnima, thank you so much for your taking the time
and
patience.
This is interesting. I saw your website, and that was fascinating about the astrology part. So do you actually, so what do you find? This is very interesting.
Well, I will send you an article about the astrology of the early days of the crisis in January. I mean, when I wrote
really?
It, it took 20 pages to just cover January.
Can you send that to me?
Happily. I'll send it in half of a second. There's more coming. And, you know, I've been so busy investigating the things you're investigating that I haven't had time to really.
How did you? This is fascinating, okay? Because I'm from India. We do a lot of astrology
yes,
there.
Yes, you do. It's a real thing.
So,
it's a real thing.
I was actually told that I would be dead before my 50th birthday. I just finished my 50th birthday, believe it or not.
Congratulations. You made it. And you're alive and kicking.
I mean, I was actually told by an astrologer, you know, he's a very highfalutin astrologer in India. He says, yeah, he told my mother I wouldn't make it to my 50th birthday. My mother freaked out, and I think that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I'll take a look and, off to the side, we'll tell you about your chart as much as I can tell you.
That I would be very interested. Yeah, that would be... very, very interesting to know.
Good.
And if you can send me that stuff on the beginning of 2020, is that right?
Yeah, it's a 20-page article on January 2020.
Oh my God! Okay, so you already had seen all this coming.
Well, no, I did it retroactively. We knew there was something big coming, but no one knew what. And then in March, I got involved investigating the PCR.
Oh boy.
Because my background is my
background. Are we going to come out of this?
Well, I will send you my writing ongoing. You are a Virgo. I've just finished the Virgo reading. I will send you that link.
Oh, my God.
I will send you that link. I finished it. Like, the last thing I did before I called you was I finished the Virgo reading. You're
in
something called your Chiron Return, which happens age 50 to 51. That's a big transition. That's the initiation that you're going through now.
Oh, God. Is that good or bad?
It's what you make it.
Oh, my God.
It's what you make it, baby. So make it.
Oh, man.
Okay, listen, I'm gonna move on. Thank you so very much. Okay. I'll be in touch early next week.
Thank you.
Yes, my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for telling me about the astrology part, because, you know, you got me thinking on that now. Mm-hmm. I mean, seriously.
Well, I think you may be the person who likes this article better than anyone.
Yeah, please send me. I would really love to read that. I had no idea you were into the astrology part so much, because I am, because of my mom, I'm sort of into it too, but this is very interesting. That would be fantastic if you could send me the stuff about the January and all those 20 pages. I would love to read it.
Yep, I'll do it before I leave the house. Okay, have an awesome night. Please take care of yourself.
You too, and thank you so much, Eric, for doing what you're doing.
Yes, and you. Okay, Pranima. Okay. Namaste. God bless.
Okay.
And bye for now.
Bye. Bye.